Hello everyone, my name is Justas Petrauskas. I'm the Oxford Political Review Global Politics Deputy Editor and a second year PPE student at Royal College Oxford. Today we are tremendously lucky to have Mr. Mantas Adomėnas, Lithuanian Foreign Vice Minister here. Mr. Adomėnas has been a Member of Parliament for Lithuania and, as I think I have a duty to declare, has studied classics in Cambridge. And Lithuania has been a prominent supporter of Ukraine in the context of Russia's aggression in Ukraine and has long argued for a tougher stance of European foreign policy in terms of Russia and China. Thank you so much, Vice Minister. It's a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you. I also must declare that I had been accepted to read for DPhil by Oriel, but Oxford, but Peterhouse, Cambridge offered better terms, so I had to decline myself from a doctorate at Oxford and go to the other place.
That's a surprise, very interesting thing. But I'd like to delve straight into foreign policy stuff now and talk about Russia's war in the Ukraine. Now, it's already been, I think, 180 days since the war started, and which upon reflection is of course a very tragic event, but you've been involved with this issue for a very long time. Could you perhaps offer your perspective of what we are witnessing now in terms of West's reaction to the issue? Is it sort of strategic realignment of perspective to acknowledge the fact that it's now a long-term conflict, or is it some sort of fatigue and complacency and sort of refocus to other more pressing domestic issues?
I think we cannot isolate a single strand of what is happening. I think the elements that you mentioned are there. That's to say, clearly the level of public support, while it remains quite high, is no longer this revolutionary fervor of support which we witnessed at the beginning of the war, and which in some countries such as Germany, the Netherlands, France, pushed the political elites to reconfigure their own position and push them into much more pro-Ukrainian stance. So while the support remains high, it's clearly not the same level. So it is waning, and we can see the signs of public attention sort of shifting elsewhere with economic wobbles, high energy prices, and associated problems. The agenda might be sort of, you know, for the audiences, especially in Western Europe, we might be looking elsewhere. In terms of political and military elites, yes, we I think sort of have the growing realization that it's a long term perspective. It's a marathon rather than sort of sprint. So there is a readjustment of calculus of means and resources which will be needed to sustain this. There is yet no wobbles regarding the overall goals, which I think is very important. And there is also a realization that we have reached a point of no return. That's to say, it's impossible to go to the situation whereby sort of, you know, some sort of detente, some sort of ceasefire could be achieved with sort of, you know, Russia still in the lands occupied after the 24th of February, because any such solution would be very clearly an encouragement for Russia to continue elsewhere or in Ukraine or sort of or to attempt some other sort of aggressive act. So now it's a proof of which side will come out best, and the realization that actually there is no return to status quo ante, however unpalatable, I think is the conclusion that we inevitably are being driven to.
Yeah. So we spoke about attitudes, and if you think about actions in terms of what we as a Western society are trying to do to contain Russia or to show Russia that this is definitely a very, very poor strategic decision, do you think the measures currently in place are adequate in terms of what we need to do, in terms of sanctions for Russian officials or Russian citizens, in terms of military and financial support to Ukraine?
You know, democratic countries do not have infinite leverage. And that's in terms of kinds and also forms of instruments that they can apply, because we are countries that operate within the legal system. In some ways, autocratic, tyrannical states have it easier because they can use famine as a weapon. They can use migration flows. They can use propaganda. They can use nuclear energy, starvation of natural gas and things like that. So you know, as tools of pressure, we operate within legally prescribed limits, and that's why the array of instruments that we have is limited. But nevertheless, they're potent. Sanctions and denial of entry is, I think, a very important instrument in the democratic world's armory. And the only thing we have to realize that, you know, we have to have strategic patience. That's to say, you know, when we're looking at sanctions, there is a bit of sanction fatigue, saying, oh, well done, they don't work. You know, the Hungarian prime minister is walking around saying that, you know, this is sanctions do not work, we should stop them, the sanctions are hurting us more than they do Russians. Which is a lie, because it's sort of, you know, they do hurt Russia, they make their attempts to reproduce the military capacity much more difficult, but also sort of, if it were not for the Hungarians, we would have much more potent sanctions. So this is totally disingenuous, but we have to realize that, you know, with sanctions we have to pile them up. As say, we had the 7th package, now we have to look at the 8th, we have to stagger them until sort of, you know, and continue staggering. And it's a sort of a process which has to go on until sort of there is a decisive victory in the war by Ukrainians. Likewise with the sort of visa bans, we have to keep expanding, and the important thing is stamina. We are in for a long haul. We can't afford to kind of let our attention wander and say, okay, well, we haven't achieved this sort of quick results, that's why let's stop doing what we are doing. No, I mean, sort of, if we keep doing what we're doing, if we keep piling them up, we'll see the results. You know, these things, given the sort of the depth of Russian reserves, it's not something that you see immediately. We know for a fact that we're depleting those reserves faster than they can reproduce them. So let's keep doing that.
Okay. I really like your analogy about running a marathon, and I think there are two strategies using which you can run a marathon. You can do everything you can, everything at your disposal, small things, big things, all kinds of things, and in sanctions that's the same. Or you can try prioritizing which ones are really, really important and worth your energy. Do you think we have some recent discussions about the visa ban for Russian citizens to enter the European Union, and some of the arguments used against that was that it's basically, we will feel good once we imply it, but eventually it will not have that much of an effect. So having your paradigm of running a marathon of sanctions in mind, do you think it's, how important is to focus on things that matter, and how important is to do just everything you can, no matter how small or how large?
Mm. Well, you know, there are several orders of priority. That's to say, you know, there are things that which bring the economic benefit, such as, you know, gas, oil, especially oil, there are things which bring a sort of, you know, a feeling of comfort, a feeling of being able to live as the war does not take place, which is you know, is not as tangible in financial terms, but it's you know, sort of extremely important for the ability of the regime to maintain the grip on their citizens, and for the regime's ability to lie to them that, you know, sort of there is no war going on. So in a sense, I think sort of, you know, we shouldn't discount one for the sake of the other. That's to say, we have to move in both tracks. If we look at the vehemence with which the regime's spokespeople react to the suggestion that tourist visas and tourist people with tourist visas could be denied entry into the EU, you know, that means that we have been doing something worthwhile, as I say, you know, it hurts already. You know, public perception is no less potent a weapon than sort of economic deprivation or technological deprivation. So, in essence, I think we have to sort of be open to various possibilities and keep several tracks going at the same time. While clearly, sort of, you know, yes, it's not worth going into areas which have no effect whatsoever, but that effect may not necessarily be purely economic.
Okay. You spoke about public perception as a powerful weapon in terms of influencing what's happening. Don't you see a sort of danger here? Because I think the people who mold public perceptions in Russia, Russian government officials, seem to have a much better arsenal of tools on how they can frame events that are happening. So, for example, if we have entry ban for Russians into the EU, who do you think has more ability to influence how that event is perceived in Russia? The government or the EU? So I'm in some sense I'm trying to provoke you a bit on considering our abilities to influence the perceptions of Russian people, given how successful the regime has been in doing that for 20 or more years.
Well, that sort of reasoning would work if the opposite approach, that's to say allowing Russian citizens to enjoy the open information sort of sphere of the West, delivered any results, but it doesn't. So in a sense, you know, we see that, you know, the support for the war is high, regardless of the fact that they can go and see for themselves that, you know, West is not that kind of, you know, anti-Russian and, you know, sort of, it's not teeming with Nazis, which are just sort of thinking how to drink the blood of the sort of innocent Russians. And that has no effect for their support for Russia and for their support to war. So, you know, simply heuristically, why not try the opposite approach, you know, and see if it delivers any results. Obviously, you know, sort of, we cannot control how this is going to be interpreted for the by the propagandists of Putin's regime. But at the moment, you know, we have two problems. One is the free rider problem. That's to say, you know, the all this sort of, you know, this population which 70% supports Putin's regime, and at the same time, so has no cognitive dissonance in enjoying the what decadent West has to offer, you know, sort of the beauties of Côte d'Azur and sort of the mansions in Mayfair. So, you know, there's a free rider problem. Another is that they can maintain the fiction that, you know, sort of war is not happening because it's sort of, you know, they can live as they continue to live. So if we close that sort of possibility to maintain normal lifestyle, then maybe sort of there's going to be a bit of disconnect with the official propaganda. And official propaganda, yes, they can control all the bits of information that are reaching you, but what they cannot, you know, what the English saying is, they can bring the horse to the trough, but you cannot make him drink. So likewise, you know, so you may force feed people with information, but you know, you can't force them to believe it. So you know, this is, maybe they will then start questioning that, you know, this propaganda narrative is not an altogether holy truth.
Yeah. Now let's backtrack a bit. We spoke about future. Let's speak about the past. It's now widely acknowledged that Europe and the West committed certain strategic mistakes in becoming too dependent from Russian energy and other spheres. Your own Prime Minister, Ekaterina Shmulyta, in her statement to The Economist, summarized it that the West was too greedy for Russian money and too delusional in its negotiations with the pathological liar. Could you give us your perspective? You have been following the events of, you know, Russian-European politics for a very long time. Where were the main delusions, main mistakes, strategic missteps that we made? And having that in mind, how can we avoid them in the future?
Right. Well, I think sort of the fundamental mistake is that quite a lot of people could not imagine that in dealing with Russia, they're dealing with sort of qualitatively something entirely different from their own logic and from their own calculus of cost and benefit. So in a sense, all these schemes and structures of thinking which maintain that in expanding economic cooperation, they were making sort of Russia dependent on the West, was totally delusional insofar as they were making themselves dependent on Russia. Not taking into account that Russia's goals may not be economic sort of benefit, but actually sort of political domination. And then it's, you know, the relation suddenly becomes deeply asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. And so Russia can sacrifice economic benefit because it already has the political sort of tools of leverage and political dependence of the West through a myriad of channels. You know, whether it's, you know, the kleptocrats of London who hire crooked lawyers and or sort of populations of Côte d'Azur, which are economically dependent on Russians, or sort of North Stream sort of gas pipelines that make sort of German industry addict of Russian energy resources. So, you know, it's not just one channel, it's sort of, you know, a plethora. So we have to sort of rethink our relations, and I think here we sort of, being in the Baltics, we are blessed with historical sort of precedents. That is to say, you know, we knew the natural aggressiveness of the Russian regime, whether in Soviet hypostasis, in its Tsarist, or in the present Putinist. We, you know, when in 2007 Putin said that, you know, the loss of Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, and pretty much sort of outlined the program of rebuilding Soviet empire in his Munich security speech. Quite a lot of Westerners took it as a sort of, you know, ravings of a resentful teenager, you know, sort of who needs to be patted on the back and saying that little Volodya, you know, we'll sort of, we love you, we understand you, all will be well, sort of, you know, and they didn't take him seriously. We read it as a sort of program for action, and we saw, you know, 15 years on that, you know, this is being implemented ad litteram. We sort of, you know, we understand the imperialist rationale behind it all, and imperialist rationale can sacrifice quite a few of its own people, even more of other countries' people, to satisfy this sort of, you know, delusional but to themselves intrinsically sort of valid visions of grandeur and domination. And this is something we have to reckon with. That's to say, you know, we're not dealing with another Assad, we're dealing with a new Hitler.
Okay. I really like how you started talking about us in the Baltics having some better experience of that. Because I want to touch upon something which I think plays a significant role in this whole Russian issue debate, and the theme which keeps emerging from the statements of the Baltic leaders, Central European leaders, in their reaction to the conflict in the Ukraine, is something close to, and I hope you excuse me for terribly simplifying that, but the reaction is, well, we are unbelievably sorry about what happened, but we've been telling you that something is going on and something like that could happen. And I think the issue I think here is that of some sort of epistemic authority on all questions Russia, meaning that who has the true access on what's truly happening in Russia or what the regime is thinking. And when you talked about how here in the Baltics we may often think of ourselves as having that epistemic authority, I have two questions for you. One is for you as a former academic, meaning that do you think anyone should be granted that epistemic authority? Who we, as an international community, think should be, I know, trusted in all questions Russia? And is the distribution of that authority, if we could call it like that, is likely to change given the context of the war?
Well, let me start by exercising my epistemic authority and saying that I'm still an academic, and again an academic, and teaching at Vilnius University. It's a difficult question. I mean, sort of recently, I think it's today or yesterday, the Prime Minister of Finland, and it's a country which is not unacquainted with Russia and the Russian threat, and has been for a number of years increasingly aware of it, nevertheless said that, you know, we should have listened to our Baltic friends sort of more intently, what they were saying about the Russian threat. In a sense, putting sort of, you know, abstractly like that, it sounds to me like a strategy of kind of disinfecting the whole issue. That, you know, sort of, in a sense, quite a few politicians, analysts in the West have been listening to the financial interests, which was whispering to them answers, which were kind of, you know, more pleasant to hear. And saying that, you know, okay, well, the Baltics are saying what they're saying because, you know, they live close to Russia and, you know, they have been occupied in the past, so they're kind of pathologically afraid and suspicious. Not realizing that actually it's a flip side of the same argument. And as you say, you know, they took to themselves the kind of argument that Russia is fundamentally sort of benign, because this is the argument and narrative that suits business community that wants profit, and profit in great amounts and with few questions asked. Whereas, you know, sort of our being exposed to it and having, as it were, skin in the game was seen as a prejudicing argument. I would say I would be with Nicholas Nassim Taleb on this and say that, you know, sort of those who don't have his skin in the game sort of are less qualified to judge the issue. And, while to, let's put it this way, sort of, you know, London property developers argument, or London lawyers argument has only sort of the flip side. That's to say, they can only benefit, but they do not. They have they stand very little to lose if Russia turns aggressive. For us, it was the opposite. That's to say, we had all to risk, but little to gain Russia proved otherwise. So in essence, I would say that our sort of test, our sort of means of what's the stone that you test the diamond with? Our acid test of Russian intentions was more valid insofar as we had more to lose from us getting it wrong. And the danger was really sort of existential, so we couldn't afford to be mistaken about it. And if we occasionally cried wolf, nevertheless this was a smaller risk compared to closing the eyes and for decades and not being able to realize the actual sort of importance and significance of invasion of Georgia in 2008, of war in Syria in 2011, and annexation of Crimea in 2014. So, you know, sort of West gladly slept through all of this and think that they can still continue reaping benefits of cooperation with Russia. So, I think on that test, on that sort of Taleb test, we come up for trumps.
Okay. And if we talk about how Lithuania and the EU in general engages with other countries who might pass that test and who might have that stake in a negative way, have we been consistent in dealing with other countries? Maybe we have some examples when we really stood on the right side of evaluating, or maybe made some great mistakes which we wouldn't like for someone to make about ourselves.
Oh, can you rephrase that? Sorry.
Yeah, surely. So you talk about that that test you have,
yes,
in seeing who can have the epistemic authority on some question. And I was thinking when you talked, when we as a country, as a European Union, when we deal with other countries who also have their own issues, and they also might have that authority in having a very big stake in something, do we respect that as well, or do we have some instances when we really manage to see that, well, this country has that negative interest in that sphere and we recognize it, or maybe we made some mistakes in neglecting and doing that? I'm just looking for our own consistency.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're asking for. It would be hard for me to find a sort of counter instance which would somehow prove where we were not heeding other countries, expert knowledge. But for example, if we want to engage with West Africa, sort of sub-Saharan West Africa, then clearly sort of we would go to the French to see, who is who and what is what, and sort of, who are the good guys and things like that. And actually it's a real happening, sort of when the current Mali government representatives come to us sort of proposing deals, with first thing sort of we consult the French who kind of, keep the tab on the region. I think there is a recognition of sort of epistemic authority, and it's in a sense a bit disingenuous for Westerners who had never been exposed to say that, okay, we know Russians better than you do, because we have more to gain. This is the underlying argument. I don't know whether I answered that, but it would be rather odd for us, for example, to start a policy on I don't know what, I mean, sort of on Venezuela, you know, without sort of consulting sort of the Spanish, for example. Sort of, yeah. Yeah, but blind spots can happen in every country's policy, I think.
Yeah, that's natural. It's nice that we started talking about more outside of the West way, because I want to touch upon the war's repercussions, not only for us who are like, directly involved, not only for the West who might be supporting Ukraine, but for the countries who are sort of watching it from the backbench or feeling the effects of the war, but not directly associating themselves with one another side. So, as a first instance, could you perhaps elaborate on the kind of effects you've been observing for these, I don't want to use the term unaligned countries, but those countries who are observing the conflict, but not necessarily standing with Russia or with the West? What are the main effects we are feeling? I don't know, energy, food, insecurity, these kind of things.
Yes, well, the last few months have been sort of quite intense from that point of view. I think there are sort of two basic rules, maybe three. the first is that authoritarian countries overall tend to be more amenable. So the more a country is authoritarian, the more it is likely to be amenable to the kind of Russian narrative about what is happening. Or alternatively, less wanting to get involved with the sort of Western sort of initiatives on sanction, on kind of excluding Russia from Human Rights Council and things like that, voting on General Assembly, UN General Assembly resolutions, so on and so forth. So that's the first rule. So there is a kind of gravitation of the like to the like, and which I think is a sort of an interesting phenomenon, because it shows that there is, you know, we are sort of moving towards the formation of two large alliances, you know, sort of free world versus sort of authoritarian, sort of, or the other kind of democracy. the second is that by and large, in sort of what you call unaligned countries, sort of bystander countries, Russian narrative has been more successful than the Western one. And numbers for that are sort of numerous. That's to say, you know, sort of, I'm not probably going to go into analysis of them, but of historical links with sort of support for anti-colonial movements, you know, exposure of political elites to direct Russian interests, to being schooled in various, you know, sort of institutions in Moscow and so on and so forth. You know, there's, you know, the certain sort of discredit to which Western narratives have been brought by other, you know, international adventures, beginning with Vietnam and so on and so forth. You know, that meant that actually, you know, overall, I think sort of Russian narrative has been winning in especially in Africa, to a lesser extent in Latin America. And the third is just sort of general kind of, you know, unwillingness to get involved somehow. And that already is, you know, sort of a stance which favors Russia. Because what they want is to get the license to invade other countries and kill other countries' people unimpeded. To obstruct them in that, you need to take action. You need to align with sanctions, you need to sort of, you know, vote in the Human Rights Council or things like that, also sort of in the General Assembly. Overall, sort of, I think it hasn't been totally symmetrical. On the other hand, the big sort of signs of hope is those countries that, you know, they do act in a principled way. I mean, sort of, you know,
beginning with examples,
Kenya in Africa, Uruguay, for example, in Latin America, have been sort of, you know, absolutely Ghana, and absolutely exemplary in this sort of, you know, rejection of this model. Because fundamentally, and this is, you know, I think fundamentally we have to put across two truths, that, you know, what Russia is doing is threatens any foundations of, you know, however flawed our sort of international order is, but nevertheless, you know, sort of any rules-based order, you know, cannot survive if Russia gets away with this. And that, you know, creates a free-for-all, sort of, you know, kind of jungle territory in the international law. The second is, I mean, sort of, you know, Bashkirs, Tartars, even the Tuvans, in despite of Shoigu, and the by now notorious Buryats and Nents, and I could go on. I mean, so the list is something like, I don't know, 200 nationalities. And this is a sort of, you know, this is a country which is based on enslavement of peoples, and it's continuing to do so. And it's the one country that hasn't relinquished its sort of dreams of colonial empire restoration for what is Crimea but a colonial sort of conquest. So we have to actually sort of call the game off of the African countries that, while sort of priding themselves on liberation or colonialism, also support Russia, which is engaged on a neo-colonial war. And this is the narrative that we have to contest. And I think that I see here the role of the EU, which is, while it contains in itself a few post-colonial powers, but these are powers that have relinquished their colonies and do not have colonial designs. And EU as a whole, you know, cannot be accused of having any sort of territorial designs on anything. So in a sense, it is a very sort of important player in that it can be a sort of objective arbiter, but also sort of disinterested player in these developments in the conflict for the influence over developing countries that is being played between China and Russia and so on and so forth. So EU can be sort of open up strategic space for those countries for really sort of disinterested, beneficial, and mutually enriching cooperation. And here I see sort of a lot of potential for much more active and much more sort of, you know, hands-on stance, but also going there with sort of, you know, with our sort of criticism of this ideological narrative. Sometimes EU is rather shy because, you know, sort of, okay, what if one of the 27 countries will object to sort of to this, you know, sort of active stance in disseminating our narrative? Well, you know, we have to have more congealed, sort of more coalesced shared position on what we want to achieve in the world and sort of the geopolitical vision for regions such as Africa, Latin America, and East Asia.
Speaking about that stronger vision, do you think there's a potential for some institutional changes in how EU's foreign policy is conducted? Because what appears to me, what you are saying, that a lot of these effects of that stance of foreign policy comes from how foreign policy is formed inside the EU, that we have 27 countries, each can have a veto, the person who is responsible for EU's foreign policy is responsible to each and every country. So do you see any potential for institutional changes here? Or do we just need to hope that we will be able to use existing institutions, existing roles, to deliver that foreign policy in a different way?
You know, I don't believe in sort of institutional reform producing a more forceful and more sort of kind of visionary content, mm-hmm. per se. So while there is a lot of in what you say that, you know, the entrenched vote of, you know, veto power kind of holding back quite a few initiatives, you know, sanctions regime being weakened and all that, I think tweaking that and perhaps occasionally acting against the offending member, such as Hungary, with moral or sort of financial or political condemnation, is a better way forward. And making these positions more attractive to top level sort of acting politicians and is also sort of a way to enhance efficiency of those institutions. For example, you know, Charles Michel, you know, managed to show quite a lot of sort of, you know, very proactive sort of diplomacy in the South Caucasus, in other regions, simply through personal initiative, using the institutional levers which were there already before. But his predecessors did not manage to use in the same sort of to the same extent in the same vein.
Now let's take a bit of a broader view. We talked about Russia, we talked about Europe, about Africa. We haven't talked about China. How do you think the Russia's war in Ukraine is likely to recast or influence the relationship between China and the West, West and Russia, Russia and China, this sort of game of international relations with three big players. Mm.
Yes, you know this novel, Chinese science fiction novel, Three Body Problem.
Yeah.
So it is a bit of a three body problem. So you know, when the kind of repulsion sort of gravitational forces pull sort of Russia and the West apart, then that's sort of, you know, inevitably, you know, the gravitation between the other sort of two lines increases. So in a sense, having a tough stance on Russia inevitably makes it more dependent on China to some extent. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, China's alignment with Russia justifies and sort of kind of you know, gives ground to the fears and to suspicions of those who were sort of initially kind of, you know, China averse. Suspicions also that China helps to kind of bypass sanctions and provide some sort of, you know, assistance even in buying sort of, you know, energy resources is also something that does not endear China to the West. You know, China-Russia relations, while sort of Russia wants to portray China as its sort of friend and ally and, you know, kind of best buddy, clearly China's view of Russia is very instrumentalized. That's to say, you know, it's useful as far as it does the function which China wants it to do. That's to say, weaken the West and distract the free world's attention to this theater of war in Ukraine, which, you know, renders the West and the United States less capable to respond to another sort of brutal theater where, you know, kind of potential tensions are brewing, which is, you know, Taiwan Straits. General sort of, you know, South China Sea region. So, you know, in essence, you know, this is a very tricky relation, and clearly, you know, sort of China has been drawing conclusions from you know, military developments on a very sort of, you know, precise basis, you know, sort of about you know, resistance and how to quash it. Taiwanese have also been drawing on that. So the stakes have been raised by all sides. So in essence, you know, well, there's no kind of a single development that characterizes the whole situation. The players have realigned themselves somewhat, and I think the only country which or the only side from this triangle which clearly lost from this realignment is Russia. It's becoming much more dependent on China and much less capable to resist sort of China's moves if it were ever to turn against Russia itself.
And speaking about Taiwan and the lessons Taiwanese are learning and Chinese learning, how would you evaluate the visit of Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan? Because Lithuania was one of the few countries to explicitly congratulate the Speaker on that visit. And could you elaborate on the reasons for your stance and what the reasons for standing out?
Lithuania was one of the few countries, but not the only. Yeah. There were also G7 plus European Commission. Mm-hmm. So one could say sort of, you know, Lithuania was one of the G9 sort of countries. Sort of, yeah. G7, EU and Lithuania, mm-hmm. Separately. Well, I think it's very important that Nancy Pelosi did what she did, because it was reaffirming a principle. And you know, quite a lot of stability of the global order and kind of prevention of new invasions stands on reaffirming the sort of the practices which were sort of there before. You know, she is not the first Speaker of the House to visit. Newt Gingrich did that as well 2 decades ago. And so, you know, this is she did what U.S. Navy ships are doing when they sail Taiwan Straits. They reaffirm the principle of freedom of the seas through their passage. By reaffirming it, they increase security overall, because they repeat that those red lines are still in place. So she basically, regardless of rather hysterical sort of China's reaction by China, she reaffirmed that the red lines which say that, you know, high-level American politicians can travel to Taiwan, that China cannot interdict that, unilaterally is very important in reaffirming the strategic space within Taiwan continues to exist.
Okay, so what I think we see is this sort of now a game of two players, a game of America reaffirming something and China reacting to that. We are interpreting these reactions as hysterical or as reasonable. But what's the place for, where's the place for Europe and countries like Lithuania in this kind of game? Do we watch as the players play, or do we try to play as well? What's our position here?
I think we kind of declared our hand by sort of allowing the Taiwanese representative office to open here. That we sort of support in principle and morally the right of Taiwanese people to live in a democratic society, this global alliance of democracies is in a sense a very important horizon to reaffirm and to support and to take action to support in the perspective of crumbling level of democracy in the world, which has been happening for the last 13 or 14 years if we look at different indices. Our commitment to that is an important principle, which is, it's not just kind of, quixotic, idealistic statement that, we support freedom and democracy all over the world. No, I mean, the decline of every democracy raises the expectations of authoritarian regimes that theirs is the future and that they can control the global future. This process has been discouraging for us for a very pragmatic reason, because only in the world where Taiwan can survive, also Lithuania can sort of hope surviving and not being sucked into a sphere of influence of some sort of resurgent neo-imperialist power like Russia. So, this is for us defending Taiwan, we defending Taiwanese people's right to live in a free democratic society. We also defend Lithuania's prospects of surviving, and so this is a fight over the global world order in which we all have to declare our stance.
Okay. And what about the countries which think strategically and choose not to declare that stance, sort of waiting for the situation to resolve? What are your takes or views or pieces of advice for the governments of such countries? Because that is also, I think, quite a prevalent strategy. Many people would really defend that quite strongly, that if you're a small player, it's better for you to watch and see how the situation resolves and then ally them with whoever or whatever is the winner.
Well, it's the strategy of those who are hoping that the dragon eat them last. But they allow sort of, by not interfering, they allow dragons to sort of, at the moment not to eat others, but at least sort of, to dragon to continue being aggressive and making noises of aggression. I don't want to draw any too precise analogies there, but it's that sort of attitude. In a sense, sort of pragmatic attitude of reaping the benefits of, for example, sort of contracts with authoritarian countries, while others are sort of resisting them. And for example, Hungary is engaged in that in a sort of huge extent. Very self-defeating in the sense that it makes, through dependency, through exposure, it makes that such country extremely vulnerable and, involves loss of sovereignty or basically ability to chart your own political course. And that might become important at some point, if suddenly, Russia turns on Hungary, it will be much less able to resist it than if it were less exposed to it. So likewise, I think sort of with this pragmatic attitude, it continues breeding dependence and thereby vulnerability. And we are sort of, entering the world where each fragility will become a major point and major source of risk. by entering a kind of a bit of immediate pain of disentangling ourselves from our Chinese import-export markets, we sort of also render ourselves more resilient and less fragile.
Okay. I think we are moving closer to the end of the time. And I want to finish with a question which involves sort of your personal experience in working in the foreign policy field, because I know, I believe maybe you will be able to assert your epistemic authority again and correct me, but I think in this job there are a lot of instances then there are things you expect and want to achieve and things you can and succeed in achieving, and sometimes there's a discrepancy between these things, especially probably for smaller countries, even such as Lithuania or the Baltic states. So, building on your experience in this field, what do you think, what's the right or correct or helpful attitude in evaluating what's possible and what's achievable, and basically how you build the foreign policy as a small country?
Right, well, this could have been the first question that we would have all, could have had all the time, you know, sort of to answer, because I think this is a major topic. You know, I'm tempted on the one hand to point out to a formative experience of my younger years when I, as a sort of 16, 17-year-old, was in the sort of national movement, Sąjūdis, sort of barricades, and witnessed the declaration of Lithuanian independence, which was by quite a few inside as well as outside Lithuania seen as an impossible thing to do. And so this current slogan then was sort of, you know, be realistic, demand what's impossible. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, there is this sort of which some might consider reckless attitude, you know, sort of seeking, demanding what is not within the realistic bounds of possibility. And by doing so, you actually kind of, you know, approximate the trajectory that you want to go. But, you know, without, if you said to yourself, you know, this is realistic, then sort of basically the result would be rather underwhelming, and by trying to do impossible, you at least do what is palatable. That's a sort of one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that what can small countries do? I mean, sort of in a room full of elephants, which are sort of kind of pushing each other sort of in the way, what can a small creature like Lithuania do? One aspect of international politics where size does not matter as much as in others is the power to form narrative. And you know, a small bird can sort of out shout the sort of those proverbial elephants, and this is, I think, what Lithuania has been doing. So, you know, it doesn't have the direct power, it doesn't have the economic, military, political muscle in a direct sense, such as, you know, sort of the big beasts of the international arena, but it has a certain power to shape the narrative through its experience, through its epistemic authority, if you want, through what it has gone through, that's to say, through its having skin in the game in the past, and thereby sort of, you know, influence the parameters of the field in which those beasts are moving. So, you know, the fact that China did not swallow the sort of the small Lithuania after the debacle of the Taiwanese representative office, which it's compared to one of the suburbs of Beijing, you know, shows that actually, sort of, you know, we can make a splash and survive.
Okay, that's a great note to finish on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.